Today's presentation is on market consistent economic profit by Conor O'Dowd and Mark Young of PwC. I'll give you brief bios of both of them. Conor is a partner in PwC's performance improvement practice based in Sydney. He's responsible for PwC Australia's service offerings in economic capital, model validation and stress testing. His professional experience, he's been a senior actuary with, he's got 20 years experience in developing and validating models and reporting tools for economic capital and risk-adjusted performance measurement, covering both insurance and financial services. He's worked closely at CRO and CFO level to help companies develop and deploy these models successfully within their organisations. Conor was formerly the lead partner of PwC's actuarial practice, helping it develop into one of the largest and most respected in Australia. Now, joining him on the microphone is Mark Young. Mark is a director in PwC's performance improvement practice based in Sydney. He works with Conor in the development of economic capital model validation stress testing offerings of the firm. He's a subject matter expert in credit, market and operational risk modelling, as well as the development of regulatory and economic capital frameworks and risk-adjusted performance systems for banks and bank assurers. Prior to joining the firm, Mark headed the Basel II project for the Australian subsidiary of a Dutch banking and assurance group. And previous to that, he headed the economic capital and portfolio management functions of a major Australian bank insurance and funds management leader and headed their economic capital and portfolio management functions. Given that we've run out of a little bit of time with Nick talking, we're going to try and keep questions to the end. We're probably looking about 10 minutes at the end, so I'll have Mark and Conor to lead off.
As we've already done this presentation before.
Yes, first thing I want to say is that this is, something that PwC as an organisation and we and a number of others in particular have been working on for some time. It's a piece of intellectual property that's currently at the point of sort of application, if you like, becoming applied research rather than simply research. We would like to acknowledge the contribution of others. We've got Tim Jenkins sitting in the audience, and Tim has had a large hand in this. And in particular, I think this, some of the breakthrough concepts you'll see here, the contribution of Dr. Mark Johnston of Macquarie Bank would be very important to acknowledge. I'm going to let Mark kick off, and then I'm going to come in somewhere in the middle. Mark.
Thanks, Tom.
This is not the first outing for this presentation. In fact, the first outing was at the Risk Minds Conference in Geneva, so you would have thought by now we would have had this a little better orchestrated. So who's sick of hearing about economic profit measures? Now, I spent a good part of my professional life doing it, and for those of my ex-CBA colleagues, and I know there are a couple of you floating in the audience, it was a topic I'm sure you heard me espouse about. But look, there's really a big difference here in terms of traditional economic profit methodology. One of the common issues that we see as a firm, and we've seen not just in banking and insurance, but just overall when you look at risk-adjusted profitability in EP or EVA or whatever name it's living with, is it's very easy to calculate it at a type of shop house for an organisation. It's equally easy, not as easy, but still straightforward to do it at a very micro level. But working out how you're able to integrate and then disintegrate those numbers at different levels of an organisation across different channels and different dimensions becomes a real issue. And that's probably where this is something of a breakthrough concept. It's a breakthrough concept in so much that it provides a very neat, very straightforward and very intuitive way of being able to do that allocation at different levels. So we are going to talk about what the limitations are very briefly in terms of risk-adjusted profitability and what we have seen as observed practice. We're going to look very briefly through, and there is a wider pack attached to this, we just in the interest of time have shortened it down, a wider pack that goes through and really does an assessment of where these things fail. And at the end, and it seems fairly pertinent at the moment, we'll be using this methodology to calculate the economic profit for a residential mortgage portfolio. We really chose it because it's the most simple example, but it gives you the key insights. So where do organisations fit in terms of what we've called a risk journey? Now, I might just step away from the microphone for a minute.
you start off right over on the right-hand side here, the risk recognition stage. And I think this is where a lot of organisations live. And they live in so much that risk isn't something you manage. It's something you try to avoid. Now, if we were to wind the clock back 10 to 15 years in the financial services industry, there's a fair portion of the current market participants who would have viewed risk as, OK, I want to get this thing off my balance sheet as quickly as possible. Then if we dial the clock forward to today, we have people sitting right up the top, and there are very few of them internationally, but there are a couple who actually see it as an enabler. They don't see it as an issue. They actually say, OK, there's some real benefit. Now, I know these all sound like motherhood statements, but it's important to put some context around this. And the context really lies in terms of where traditional economic profit measures, come a cropper, is in the box we've got here. Yes, you think about risk-adjusted profitability, but it's still... And yes, you see it as an opportunity cost, but it's still very much viewed as a measurement process, not as part of your business setting strategy. And we're going to go on to talk about how MCP kind of changes that dynamic. So, two key issues we'll talk about. So what's up with current approaches? And maybe there's a fresh way of looking at this. And we look at it from the three constraints of risk, capital, and profit. And we take a slightly different interpretation. So let's just step through this. I know it looks like a fairly intimidating sort of slide, but it isn't. Traditionally, most people tend to view risk, capital, and then in turn performance as really a driver. And it gives you a result, but I guess practically one of the issues you have at the end of the day is it doesn't necessarily answer some of the more fundamental questions about the fact if I take a particular strategy, it will have an outcome on my profitability. Let's put capital to one side for a moment. Now, I know in current conditions, talking about whether an organisation is solvent or not and then actually pushing that out to one side does seem a little going against the grain. But I think it's important to remember that we have defined solvency strategies, we have defined solvency methodologies that tell you how much money or how much capital you should be holding. And trying to tier performance to that, although it does give you a lot of insight, can sometimes provide you with answers that don't necessarily make sense in the cold, hard light of day when you think about performance. Now, as an anecdotal example, I can remember working for a very large institution who had a very large home loan book. And when you looked at the capital and performance methodology, you found they had products there with triple-digit returns. Now, admittedly, the products were performing very well. They weren't really performing that well. But some of that was because this construct, although telling you something, didn't necessarily tell you something that the organisation understood or felt. Now, just as a refresher for anyone who's not seen it before, traditional economic capital measures, economic profit measures, really say, okay, I have a profit and I will remove a capital charge away from it. And that capital charge is whatever my cost of capital is, a CAPM-derived measure, and the capital there may be economic capital or some variant of risk-based capital. There are a whole Pandora's box of issues in terms of, okay, how do I actually figure out what that risk-based capital is? If I'm a level 3 conglomerate and I've got an insurance company and a bank and a fund manager, how do I consider putting those together? Are there diversification benefits inside there? Do I do this on a standalone basis? Should I actually adjust the profitability measure in there? All of these concerns come home to roost. Now, it gives you an answer, but it may not necessarily be an answer that's interpretable to anybody. There's another way of thinking about this. And it's not to say that capital's not important, because it is. And in fact, in the environment we're in right now, it's very important. But we have to stand back for a moment and think about, okay, let's say, and we'll take a bank as an example, because it
it's something where you can get some relativity around this. How does the investor think about what the bank looks like? How does the investor think about what the profitability of the business is? Do they actually think about the capital constraint as the first shot? And the answer is typically no, they don't. They're more interested in, okay, how's your performance measured against what your profit is? I kind of take for given that if you need to go and do capital raisings, you'll do that. So it's shifting the whole discussion here from, I'll think about capital and capital consumption, and it's not to say that it's not important, but I'll move it over to the discussion of, if I was valuing this object like any other corporate transaction as part of a financial economics transaction, how would I think about the profit that this entity is deriving, not necessarily the capital that it's chewing up from a performance standpoint? That changes this whole picture quite significantly. So I've kind of left you with the, okay, traditional methods don't work, and maybe we need to rethink it. I'm going to hand over to Connor now, and Connor will walk you through how you actually do start valuing something from that perspective and how it gives you some different results. Connor?
Thanks, Mark. So this brings us to, I suppose, the nub of the paper, which is this concept we're calling market-consistent economic profit. So the things we want to cover are what are the basic building blocks we've come up with, and a little bit about the theory and some formula, a very, very light formula. Not that this audience would worry too much of a formula that weren't light, of course. Look, I suppose considering the way economic profit works currently, we came up with a number of desirable properties of a sound economic profit measure. And the first is that it should be additive across the group. So if you've got a financial conglomerate or any other sort of conglomerate, economic profit of each of the components can be added together to produce the economic profit of the whole. Current measures struggle with that because, although technically the measure is additive, it relies on a capital allocation, which is certainly not additive, has a very problematic diversification benefit problem sitting in the middle of it. And secondly, what we're calling scalable, it should be able to be measured really at any level in the organization. Again, the current approach relies on a cost of capital to be applied to the capital allocation, and that cost of capital, although you can sometimes measure it at the top level of an organization, you can only measure it with successive approximations as you go down the organization to the individual businesses and business units within it. What we're calling integrated is we wanted the measure to be meaningful and to relate to a concept of value. So it's that investor's view, what is the value of an organization and what is the value of the individual components of that organization. And so a market-consistent value or an economic value, if you prefer. And finally, rigorous, we wanted it to be underpinned by a rigorous valuation framework based, as you'll see, on modern portfolio pricing theory. So the fundamental building block is that the value of an asset comprises a risk-free component, which is the payoff of that asset discounted at the risk-free rate, and a risk component we're calling the risk charge, which isolates out the effect of risk on the value. And then market-consistent economic profit is equal to the actual profit earned, less that risk charge. And for an organization that holds capital against that risk, a funding charge, which is very simply equal to the risk-free rate times the capital. So instead of looking at, for example, cost of capital, which includes a risk element within it, and applying that to the capital, we're splitting the cost of capital into those two components, and we're deriving the risk charge by looking at the risks and the funding charge by looking at the capital. So this is the first of our formulae, and not too challenging. It relies on the concept of stochastic discount factors, which are one of the sort of basic building blocks of modern portfolio pricing theory, and what you see there is that the price of an asset is equal to the expected value of the payoff of the asset, which is X, and this thing called M, which is the stochastic discount factor, which, given the state of consumption at the time X is realized, contains an implied discount rate, risk-adjusted discount rate. So it's M times X. So if you can imagine a distribution of returns from an investment, there's a separate M containing a separate implied risk-adjusted discount rate for every value of X. So the payoffs that occur at the time when, say, the market is depressed get valued differently to payoffs that occur at the time when the market is buoyant. Or I should say the state of consumption, but generally the market is used as a good proxy. So that basically illustrates it. M covaries negatively with consumption. So you can see that there's a different discount factor in the extreme of the distribution of X than there is at other points. So that's an illustration of X that is generally mostly uncorrelated with consumption. But if you have an asset that's correlated with consumption, that gives you the price. If it's correlated with consumption, you basically get a lower price in this case because the negative outcomes, and this would be a sort of a credit risk type of scenario, the negative outcomes are actually correlated with times when the market is depressed. So basically at the time when you have least capital, if you like to think of it, you've got to find more capital because you've got to make up for the unexpected loss. And MCEP is fully risk-adjusted, and in the multi-period model, which we've taken a skip to here, it's basically a forward-looking prospective valuation of an asset, and the economic profit in any year is equal to the value of that asset at the end of the period, discounted at the risk-free rate, take away the value of the asset at the start of the period. And that's your expected generation of MCEP, from which you can later come along and compare actuals. So it's something that actuaries should be able to easily relate to because it's fundamentally based on valuation principles. And here's what MCEP comes down to in terms of symbols. The profit you earn in a year, capital P. The risk charge turns out to be based on the covariance of M and X. So if you had, generally speaking, a negative covariance, then you accumulate that to the end of the period. That becomes a risk charge, even though it's got a plus sign because the covariances are generally negative. And the funding charge is equal to P, which is the opening value of the asset times the risk-free rate. So that separates the risk element from the funding element. And that, very importantly, is what provides that additive quality we wanted because covariances are additive. Generally speaking, if you look at capital allocation mechanisms, they're based on other concepts such as value at risk or tail value at risk, of things which are basically not additive across distributions. Covariances are additive. So that's certainly one of the breakthrough concepts in this presentation. Of course, we could simply leave it at that and say, well, we've told you how to do it now. Just go and figure out M and figure out your covariance of M and X and basically Bob's your uncle. But it is, of course, quite difficult to work out what is the distribution of outcomes of an asset and then further how they correlate with state of consumption or with market returns. So in order to do that, and I should emphasize this is just one example of how this might be implemented, we come up with the concept of a value driver. And I suppose the best way of explaining this is broadly to think of models that basically do look at stochastic outcomes, such as DFA models. Think about them for a little while. DFA models are usually built from the bottom up, but imagine building one from the top down and just looking at the important outcomes and looking at the how those important outcomes drive the important business outcomes and therefore the cash flows underlying your business. Your business is the asset we're trying to value. The randomness and value drivers are often correlated together because of systematic risk. So the correlation between different value drivers or different risks, if you like, in a business occur because of a systematic component. And building it top-down, you allow for those, or you take out those systematic components and model them separately. So to apply the stochastic discount factor to a particular asset, the correlations of the value drivers to this growth and consumption needs to be determined. We set ourselves a task of a methodology that could be applied really using simple existing financial models, so existing budget models, because this is not particular to life insurance or general insurance or even to financial services firms. This is a concept that can be applied to any asset or any business. So if we start with a simple budgeting model, which starts at revenue, which is equal to price times volume or something like that, and you look at price and how that is breaks down in the presence of uncertainty, you look at the same thing with volume, and so on down. So there's a very simpler, a much simpler DFA approach based around the key value drivers. It's the drivers of profit, whereas in the insurance game, I suppose we think a lot about assets and liabilities. This is based around the drivers of profit rather than assets and liabilities. The other final, I suppose, building block, given that we'd set ourselves the task of being able to use simple budget models, we didn't want to have to build DFA models out of them. For some people, for some reason, people's eyes glaze over when you go in and suggest you should build a stochastic simulation-based model for their, what they thought was a very simple budgeting model. So we really wanted to come up with a closed-form solution and a multi-period setting, and that has been done. But, of course, as usual with closed-form solutions, we need to make some simplifying assumptions, and these are compared with other simplifying assumptions that you would make typically when you use a CAPM framework. These are actually quite light. You need to have a utility function to specify M, and we use constant relative risk aversion, so it's proportional to the proportion of the loss of the original asset value or accretion of the original asset value. Our value drivers, which are things like growth in revenue, which might be growth in price or growth in volume, are expressed as in growth rates, and that allows us to use log-normal distributions for value driver growth rates. So we're looking at proportional increases in the makeup of revenue, costs, and so on. And we have to assume they're identically distributed from period to period and log normals. And the business cash flows basically continue indefinitely in a multi-period setting. So we're looking at, as I said, a prospective valuation model. The formula-based approach, because it turns out to be a formula with only about four terms, actually makes MCP very, very straightforward and easy to implement in even very basic budgeting spreadsheets. We have prepared a case study. This will necessarily, I think, be quite brief because of the time, but we're happy, obviously, to take questions. It's of a mortgage business, and Mark will take us through that now.
And to answer the obvious question before anybody asks it, yes, or the really cool formula, the ones that make all this hang together aren't in the presentation. But we'd be more than happy to show you back at our offices. Very simple example, and this simple example could be an annuity. I mean, we have taken really the most straightforward case we could think of. So it's a standalone business. It has one mortgage portfolio in it. And in terms of value drivers, and I guess this is the other point as well, just to elaborate on what Connor's already said, this approach will work equally if you want to use a full set of stochastic drivers sitting underneath it, as well as it will using closed form. When you use closed form methods to actually look at what the price is going to be, the issue becomes more about how do you set the value drivers inside the framework. And we also have an approach where we can show you how to go through in a structured way and look at your value drivers. I guess before jumping straight into the example here, a lot of what this approach is about is making it simple and straightforward for people to understand how to do this stuff, not necessarily overcomplicating it with formula, but having the right sort of mathematical rigor sitting underneath it. So let's just quickly look at the steps. One, you need to identify the business unit drivers. Now, for this one, we've decided new business volumes, their funding, which I think is particularly pertinent right now given the way credit spreads on funding have increased, whether you're keeping customers and what the overall credit quality looks like are all important considerations. Then for each of those we say, okay, what do we expect to see? How variable do we expect those returns to be? And what sort of consideration do we give around correlations? So we've taken three cases here, and I'll just step over to the screen so we can walk through these quickly. And I know these are hard to read, but I'll read through them for you anyway. Risk-free rate, we've assumed 5%. We've assumed an investment of $100 and a time horizon of 1 year. We've got a correlation matrix for each of our drivers, and in turn a correlation driver around what the returns are going to look like and what the implied rate of consumption or market return is. We've taken three very simple strategic outcomes or scenarios. The first one being, okay, things basically stay the way they are. The second one is, there is an economic downturn and you decide not to change your strategy. And the last example is, there is an economic downturn and you decide to change your strategy. Now, what does that actually mean? Well, it means, and one here assumes just the value stays as is, so it says, all right, I'm making 8 cents on the dollar up here. If there is a major shift, and when the pack comes out, you will be able to see these numbers. I know they're a little hard to read at the moment. Okay, I see a loss of $10. And then the last example, well, it's worth $96. I see a decrease of $6 in terms of a decrease in $10, so I've net not lost as much, which, taking all the other items into account, means that I've still destroyed value, so my economic profit is still negative. So let's just quickly walk through how you would have got there. The first set, we have made an assumption about, as I said, what the driver forecasts look like, and that's the expected growth rate, what the standard deviation is, and most importantly, how the weightings fit in terms of each one of those drivers. For the first example, as we've talked about already, you know what your profit is, you know what your risk charge is, and you know what your funding charge is. Now, your funding charge is pretty simple here. It's a 5% risk-free rate, which means it's $5 based on a $100 investment. That ends you up with your MCP of $1.08. We then go to the second example where we say, okay, we've got funding stress, volumes have been restricted, and the guts have dropped out of credit quality. And we get an MCP, which is significantly lower, saying, if all these things drop, I know how much it's going to be worth. And it's important, and sometimes this is where these measures get a little lost. I mean, without pushing the point too hard, this just gives you an impression of, okay, what's the effect on these things? What do they actually mean? What's the outcome? And then we go to... Oh, sorry. So what we've talked about today is really... And look, we're happy to go through the math. It does get a little ugly. There are really four significant or key concepts that underlie this entire approach. And I dare to say we've not seen anywhere else in any of the other economic profit methodologies around. One, you can split this up at any level and simply add the numbers back up. So if you have 10 business units, you calculate an MCP for each one of those 10, you add up the aggregate MCP and calculate MCP for the unit going down, the two numbers will be the same. That leads you onto the scalability. It's integrated from the sense that you can separate risk profile very clearly, and it's rigorous. It won't move around as a result of the allocation methodology. So if it's a cost allocation methodology you're using or a capital allocation methodology. And these are one of the sort of standard slides that just give you a feel for how it actually fits together in terms of the entire risk, value and strategy framework around actually telling you everything you're supposed to know rather than just giving you a measure which may not necessarily align with your business. Thank you for your attention. If you've got any questions now, I think we'll open the floor up to questions.
If you have questions, please just come forward to the microphone and say your name. Remember, the questions will be recorded. Any brave souls to start us? Right, it looks like I'll have to start a question to get the audience going. Mark, I guess in our previous life when we've worked together, we were involved in implementing Baal 2, and one of the complicated mathematical outworkings of that was the operational risk capital calculations, which became an area where management suddenly became aware their capital could change based on some very complex actuarial modelling, or statistical modelling, I should say, and lots of assumptions on which there was not necessarily a lot of data. In your discussions, I guess, that you've had with firms potentially in talking about implementing these types of methodologies, could I maybe get you to talk about what sort of reactions you've seen from, you know, businesses in terms of the attitudes or aversions or understandings?
As the actuary between the two of us, I should probably take that one, James. I think we've had a number of conversations, as you put it, and a number of applications which we've presented, probably quite a topical one. The key here is that these are not complex actuarial calculations. There is an underlying engine which produces the valuation framework, but at the end of the day, we're using very simple models, as you've seen, with four drivers, for example, to represent a mortgage business. But they are, you know, if you take a top-down view of what affects the value of a mortgage business, those are the four things you come up with. And that's done with the client, if you like. He knows what drives the value of his business, or he's soon going to tell you. And therefore, we've seen the businesses actually get quite immersed in this stuff. I think there is then the, once you start using this for performance measurement, if I could put it like that, there is the question of how you actually control the numbers, if you like, that you put on the value drivers and the growth and so on. And so there's a need for a control framework around this, but that's the same with any performance measurement system. And that's probably where the centre, the group, or whatever you want to call it, would suggest that there are, you know, issues still to be resolved, if you like, with this framework, because so much of the output, so much of the parameters, if you like, are come out of management input into the thing. But anyone who's tried to do economic capital or economic profit will tell you that the hardest thing to do is get the buy-in of the business. This one seems to work the other way around, and so it does seem to work a little bit better.
It's an interesting question. I mean, I've lived through two organisations now where I've seen a lot of effort and time and money being put into measuring capital, and I think it's very important. I think the difference about a measure like this is it not that it necessarily obfuscates the need for doing that capital management, but what it does is it actually puts it in the place it's supposed to be around thinking about capital rather than trying to link it to all the other things at the same time. Certainly in talking to some of our clients, particularly about this measure, there wasn't we don't get it concept. The concept they were more into was, okay, tell us how you get those value drivers. Yep. And from the experience we've had, that's actually where you get the benefit. The benefit, the model itself does provide you with a very neat mathematical framework to come out with some results, but actually tuning it to what people think is going on inside their business is more important. And the experience, professional experience I've had also tells me as well that often the corporate memory that's sitting in those guys' minds is way more than any model is ever going to be able to tell you.
Any questions?
I'm Rob Bailey. With your choice of M for the stochastic discount factor, does that just vary with market risk? Because I think one of the key issues with that is what drives that. So is it just market risk, or is it the total the market return, or is it the company profit? So the reason I ask is I'm concerned that a non-market risk would be treated as risk-free, because there's no covariance between that and M.
No, it's a measure of consumption, so it's not just simply a measure of, say, liquidity from a market perspective. There's a lot more sitting underneath it than that. I guess the other comment as well, and I don't want to use this as a get-out-of-jail-free card, but you may have seen at the start of the presentation in a number of ways through, we are a little guarded about talking about some of the derivation. The derivation of M along with the funding charge is actually what makes the whole thing, I guess, hang together. Connor, have you got any comments?
There are a number of, I mean, what measure you use for consumption is kind of an open topic, I suppose. Yeah. And market returns is only one, although a widely adopted one. But we've looked at other measures such as growth in corporate earnings, or which would be sort of aligned to what CFOs would be interested in, if you like, in terms of measuring themselves against. But frankly, market returns is one that is at least, I suppose, objective, if I could put it like that.
I mean, there's another consideration here as well. To some degree, the choice of M will also dictate it for the type of business you're looking at. So for some businesses, there'll clearly be a cyclical link between changes in market behaviour and, in turn, changes in the underlying value. But other businesses, classic life insurance, may not be as directly affected, and there might be another way of determining that M that gives you a little more insight about what's going on with the business. I guess that's the other big consideration here. This model isn't simply just a one-size-fits-all. Where it really gains traction is where you actually sit down and tune it, as we talked about with those drivers, to the underlying business. But please.
I'll just, it's a bit of a leading question that I ask, because I actually want to put in a plug for a paper that I'm going to be presenting tomorrow afternoon, which actually talks about M.
Oh, very good.
Oh, well, we look forward to that.
Excellent.
And actually comes up with a way for coming up with M, which is actually fairly simple, and is the stochastic discount factors that we are already using when we value financial risks.
Excellent.
So actually the other thing, because I've studied this, looked at this as well, and actually quite glad that between the two different papers we've come up with them very separately, but we've come up with the same names. Because there are lots and lots of names to describe what you've already done, and it's all in the academic papers. So I thought I'd just put in a plug for myself as well.
Oh, good. It did have another name. It was called True EP at one point as well. We decided we'd call it Market Consistent Economic Profit because there's a framework in clearly Europe of market consistent embedded value. There are a lot of similarities between these frameworks. Are there any other questions?
I'll ask another one there, Mark, and I guess someone may have to be worried since I saw a registered trademark little logo appear on the MCEP in the paper. In terms of this measure of profit, I guess when I've worked with the corporate finance colleagues within my firm, everything that can be done simple is done as simple as possible, and the evaluations of companies tends to be just PEs, regardless of what fancy valuations we do and what data we give them. Everything's all about a PE multiple, and the way they do all of their working out what company should buy what company is based on who's got a low PE. With all of this profit that you've derived, or this measure of measuring profit, does it have a role outside internal management measurement? You know, I'm thinking in the external reporting sort of environment and analysts and the way that they will apply this profit, is it too subjective to be used outside?
No, not at all. In fact, is there anyone from S&P in the room? Oh, good. Not that there's anything wrong with S&P, but when the rating agencies do actually look at an organisation, my understanding is, as an ex-banker, that they'll go through and do a process that's not overly dissimilar to this, but no, you're right, they will keep it fairly simple and straightforward. Anecdotally, I could imagine there'd be some strong cases for using this sort of framework to actually value a business, and one could make an argument that it might give you a slightly more complete answer. If we think about how a rating agency would typically value a business, they're often thinking about an MVA-type measure or a market value add, and that market value add is not overly dissimilar to what we've talked about here, although... I think ours has got some features which something like a classic MVA doesn't necessarily, not that it doesn't deal with, but it has issues, and it's that whole splitting of the risk-free and risk components into separate parts. I think it's done a little more cleanly here than some of those measures. So, yes, I think you could. I think there'd have to be a very careful story told about how the numbers are actually arrived at, though.
Measurement, I suppose, in this. Can you give me any examples or good examples of what different decision-making management might make if they had a framework like this in place?
We probably did rush through this one a bit. Yes, we did in the interest of time here. Yeah.
But this is the, the change in strategy slide. And I guess we're seeing an organisation that thought it was adding value to the extent of $1.08 out of every 100 in a scenario now where it's going to lose $10 because of reduced volumes and higher funding costs and so on. Disimproving credit risk, I mean, everything hits you at once. Obviously, not only do the numbers tell you the measurement of it and therefore how you might explain it when you're called upon to do so, but it starts to get you thinking about, well, if these are my primary levers, what could I do to change things? And we've shown a scenario which adds back about sort of two-thirds of what was lost through the bubbles you see on the right-hand side. So basically, yes, we will have restricted volume, but we're going to fund more on the balance sheet because we can't securitize it. Therefore, you know, if you can imagine management working out how to do these things and coming up with scenarios and putting them through the model. But these things are not adding risk, and that's the important thing. So we're not sort of saying, well, we're going to write business no matter what quality it is, or because, of course, you're just putting credit risk on balance sheet, and that's going to come home. You know, the economic value of that is going to reduce, could reduce the value even though you're increasing your business volumes. And we're not going to just pursue liquidity at any cost. We're going to try and be clever about it. So we'll write less business, but we'll write improved business and hopefully pull it around over a 2 to 3 year period. And so that's how it works, basically. It couldn't be simpler than that. It really does concentrate management on the core drivers they've got.
Yeah, I mean, to answer your question, to pick up on Connor's points, a lot of this framework is about just putting some, certainly the drivers, some simple measures around where you are and where you want to be, and the changes in measures will equate to a change in strategy. So you can actually use it as part of your decision-making process. And certainly for this example, this was all done in a spreadsheet. It was done very simply. There was nothing fancy about it, and that's how we derived the results. I mean, clearly, if you want to get a more sophisticated version, you can, but a lot of the insight comes out of just simple calculation.
There's a lot of work around the background.
Yes.
To be fed to feed anything sensible into this. So, and that's where it should be done, of course.
Yes, indeed. So good technical underpinning, but a straightforward implementation.
Hi, Catherine Johnston. I just wondered how robust the underlying model that you've built is in terms of, I guess you come up with it based on a current scenario of how things are and what your key volume drivers are, and if you do have a major sort of different economic downturn or something, or change in the environment that you're working in, maybe to the extreme, maybe not quite so extreme, can you still use your same underlying model, or do you need to change that? So how robust is it to changes in the environment that you're working in? So can you keep using the same one forever? Or
it's a good question, actually. The model itself is completely robust. It's not going to change. And a lot of that is because, I guess, one of the tricks is the actual utility function that gets used inside here would be the main point where you would need to vary what the outcomes look like. Though we have quite deliberately chosen that utility function because we think it's consistent with how risk is going to change, i.e. if things get worse, you need more capital because they've got worse. To the degree that it's got worse is more just a case of scalar rather than it is of methodology. So the methodology won't change. What will change is the inputs. And I mean, the example here really just tries to illustrate the construct here ain't going to change. You're not going to... we are not going to see massive changes in terms of the way the numbers come out because the methodology falls down. The numbers will change as a result of the fact that you actually change these assumptions, which means that what comes out at the back end looks very different to what you had based on a current assumption. It kind of also says that's why if you were going to do this in a more complete sense, you'd do a full stochastic representation and have a distribution of returns, and then you could pluck off the returns. And I mean, I guess what we've done here to illustrate it fairly simply is just taken some simple cases and looked at the returns and said, here are some point estimates. But in terms of stability, the model is stable. It's more a case of the underlying drivers will change. And also you've got to go through the processes and say, are the drivers you're using the right ones for the business that you're running? And that's in some ways actually more difficult than the model.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the value of the business is the value of the profits. And if the profits change, well, your value is going to change. And that can be changed by the business environment. But the underlying valuation assumptions will change slowly, and those changes, well, obviously you will try and re-estimate things, and things will change. And like any other actuarial model, you'll manage, you know, the change of assumptions and the change of basis separately to the change in environment. So there's nothing specifically very challenging for an actuary in this.
We have time for probably one more question. If anyone has it burning on their chest, they have to get off. I will ask you to thank Mark and Connor in the traditional way. Thank you.